Welcome. My name is Susan Daffron, and I'm the president of Logical Expressions, which is a book and software publishing company based in Idaho. I'm also the president of the Small Publishers, Artists, and Writers Network, otherwise known as SPAWN. So thanks for listening. Today we're talking to David Siteman Garland about smarter, faster, cheaper, and non-boring ways to market your business. And David is the founder of The Rise to the Top, which is the number one non-boring resource for building your business smarter, faster, cheaper. And he's also the author of a new book that is actually just launched this week called Smarter, Faster, Cheaper, Non-Boring, Fluff-Free Strategies for Marketing and Promoting Your Business. Say that 10 times fast. And he writes and hosts Rise, which is a web show for entrepreneurs, forward thinkers, business owners, and marketers, as well as the Rise to the Top TV show on ABC. So welcome, and thanks for being here, David.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm trying to think of my best Idaho joke, but you know, I don't have any good ones. But
you got to think of something about potatoes.
I had the potato ones, but I didn't have anything original, so I decided just to go with silence. But thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking time out of your big book launch activities. I know this is a huge week for you, so this is we're really glad that you were able to take the time out amidst all the excitement and talk to us here at SPAWN.
Oh, my pleasure. As long as I have a voice, I'm good to go. So,
really? Cool. So you very kindly sent me a copy of your book, which I almost made it through, but I did at least skim the end that I didn't get through last night that I was supposed to finish last night. But anyway,
that
got
counts.
Close.
It counts.
I know. It counts. Skimming counts. But the first main thing, and obviously this comes from the title, your book is advocating avoiding old-fashioned, what you call dumb, slow, and expensive marketing methods in favor of smarter, faster, cheaper ones. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit what you mean by this.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because it's hard to say that something is completely dead. You know, because I love it whenever you say something's dead, someone's like, well, here's an example, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Of it still being alive. So I want to be careful with how I approached it. But the way that I saw it, and the book is really designed for essentially smaller, if I were to even go specific, but entrepreneurs and people that are hustling, artists, creatives, mm-hmm. People that are in your world here, like in the publishing world, people that create something, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the old ways were never an advantage for us whatsoever, meaning the Davids and the David versus Goliath, sort of pun intended there. And meaning that the ways they used to be was this. You would create a product or you know, it's a service or whatever that might be. It might be a donation if it's a nonprofit, whatever it is. But you had something where money is exchanged. And the old way that used to go about it was that your goal as a marketer or as a business owner, whatever it may be, or as a publisher, was to get as many people as possible to buy that product or service, and you pushed it out. You would push it out through ads. You would push it out through traditional media methods. If you had money, you would get a PR firm that would try to pitch you to a bunch of media, and mm-hmm. this was the way it was always done. But the problem was, I mean, this was never an advantage for the smaller person because the smaller person, we couldn't afford those type of things to do. And the world has completely changed now where it's flipped, and now we have the advantage, the little guys, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, you know, speaking of your book, nowhere is this more true than in publishing where big publishers are scrambling to change a lot of things that they've been doing for literally decades, and whereas small publishers are really being quick to see the changes in the business, and this is just happening all, you know, across multiple industries. Obviously, I know about publishing more than other ones, but it really does level the playing field where your book is sitting next to, if you're a self-publisher, your book can be sitting right next to the shelf from books from enormous publishers with huge staffs and sometimes even sell better. You just never know.
And it's funny. Yeah, I mean, the publishing world is a great example. And, you know, it's so cool to watch that now the smaller, I mean, you know, the smaller publishers, I think, just in general, because I'm such an advocate of publishing in so many different ways, mm-hmm. and the smaller publishers now have the advantage in this world because between social media and the ability to create an online platform and the ability to connect with people one-on-one, whether it's on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or other social media sites, you know, that is essentially the way it used to be in business. And, like, you know, in the pre-internet days, is you would do business with the person on the corner that you knew and liked and trusted. And it's almost like a return to that humanization and smaller business now because of how the internet's evolved. And it's cool because some of these bigger companies are just really slow moving. Like, we were joking before this started, it's like a herd of turtles.
Yeah.
In many cases. It just is. Like, by the time that they've talked to the legal team and have 907 lawyers and 47 marketing firms and all these people figure out what's going on, you can get in there and do some damage as the little person, which is what I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well, one key in your book that comes out a lot and is also in the title is that all the, you know, the key is to be non-boring. And you know, what I wonder is what is making things stand out? Like, you always have people like Seth Godin, who you've interviewed, and they're always saying, oh, be remarkable, be fantastic, you know, do
right.
something amazing. And but, I mean, sometimes, I mean, I don't know about you, but some
fluffy.
Days I've, yeah,
fluffy.
I feel... Yeah, I just feel a little boring. And like, you know, a lot of people who are members of Spawn, you know, were editors. I was a tech writer before I started my own business, which is, I mean, what is more dull than a tech writer? I mean, think about Tina the tech writer and Dilbert. I mean, who is more maligned and dissed than the poor, sad tech writer? So it's like, you know, some of it's like, how can we pull what's remarkable about what we're doing so that we can actually get, you know, so that we're not boring and we do get noticed? Because I think that that's
sure.
something that a lot of people struggle with.
Absolutely. And it's funny because a lot of people, when they hear that kind of term, and they'll say, well, what does that actually mean? And I was on a quest with that with the book, too, of finding, like, you know, how do you quantify something being non-boring or how do you,
yeah.
a better way of saying it is, how do you get other people interested in it, right?
Uh-huh,
and,
exactly.
And the way that I see it is this. We make this mistake, and I think that there's a tendency to do this, and it makes sense when you think about it. The mistake that we make when it comes to, let's just use online as an example. It's not just online, but let's just use online. Is that someone will set up a website, or they'll set up a blog even, or, you know, they'll get involved in social media. They're getting out there. But the problem is that way too many people are still focused on their products and services that no one cares about.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you're not getting people excited if you just talk about your product and service all the time, because the reality of it is nobody cares about our products and services except ourselves, right?
Exactly,
so people,
yeah.
People want to be entertained. They want to be interested. They want to be inspired. They're, you know, they don't want – think about why you consume content. Let's just use online. Why do you read a blog or why do you read something? Because, you know, you want to be educated, entertained, or inspired, right?
Exactly.
And the idea behind this – is that you have to do that. And I can give a perfect example of something in a non-sexy industry and what they've done using kind of the smarter, faster, cheaper method. So let's just use a company called HubSpot, okay? HubSpot is in one of the most boring industries in the world. And I love this example because the industry is boring and crowded, so it avoids two stereotypes, okay?
Two strikes
so
against
here it
them.
Is. Software industry, okay? And what they do is they create – like a lead generation software for your website. So, you know, like contact forms and things like that where people, they help your website generate more leads, right? Not exciting. We do not go to bed thinking about lead generation software unless you're really weird. But instead of doing all the old ways, which would have been this, they create the software, they create a website that says buy the software, right? Then
yeah.
they go out everywhere and they spam everyone and they go on Twitter and they say buy the software and then no one does. So they say buy the software for 10% off and no one does. So they say buy the software for 20% off, no one does. And, you know, that's the way we see it. They start that they could have pushed the product. They could have bought a lot of banner ads on a lot of random sites, which would have cost them a fortune. They
mm-hmm.
could have done a lot of different things. But none of that is allowing people to know, like, and trust them, and no one's going to rally around that, right?
Yeah.
So what do? They took a completely different approach. And what they did is they said, okay, forget that. We want to become viewed as the experts and the trusted resource when it comes to marketing and generating leads, so essentially online marketing for small businesses. That's our customer is small businesses. We want to become the place they go when they think of, like, internet marketing for small businesses. So what they did was they started creating content online around that very subject. They started an internet marketing blog where they were not pushing the software. Instead, they were educating. They were talking about ideas and case studies and stuff, though, that was interesting to a small business owner. And I think that's the massive takeaway, is that they took themselves, put them into the shoes of a common interest and passion between the company and the small business owner, and then went after that, because people rally around things that we're interested in or passionate about, right?
Yeah.
And so what they do is they have this blog. Now they've gone crazy. So they have a weekly web TV show where they go over hot marketing headlines for the week. They've done funny photos. They've done all this content that comes out on the web. And what ends up happening is they become the go-to source now that, oh, by the way, sells a product.
Mm-hmm.
And there's gentle reminders to buy the product. There's a free trial. There's all these different things that you can do to take that next step. But it's the ultimate in soft selling. And what ends up happening is these writers and these people that are writing for HubSpot that work for that company, they've become sort of like mini celebrities, if you will, because they show their knowledge. Now they're speaking at conferences. They're kind of spread out, and they have more of a force of people that are educators and entertainers and inspirers, not a word, that are out there really, you know, getting their brand out there, and they're marketing an interest and a passion, and that's how they rally people around it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are crushing that industry. I mean, it's unbelievable, just absolutely crushing it.
Well, one thing is that you say that in the book, you say this actually multiple times, you say money follows passion and not the other way around. And one thing that's sort of interesting is that I know actually a lot of people actually struggle with, you know, the cliche of finding their bliss or their passion. So when you were figuring out what you were going to do, how did you figure out what you were passionate about to start, you know, the rise to the top?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, and here's a disclaimer on this. If you are not passionate about what you're doing, nothing in the book will work.
Yeah, really.
So I wish, you know, it is designed for the person that wants to do this and not the person that has to do this, if that makes sense. So, you know, for me, and I think I'm a fairly common example, because here's the thing. A lot of times when we hear the word passion or we hear the word, like, you know, interest, we think of something that was like you wanted to do since childhood. Like you were the little guy sitting, like I would have been like a 3-year-old with a microphone saying I'm going to be on camera one day, right?
There you go.
And I think that's great for the people that can do that. I was not one of them, and I've noticed that most people are not in that category where they all had an undying passion since birth. If they have that and they're doing it, that is perfect, and if you know what it is, that's even better. But what I've started to notice is that by experimenting and trying different things, based on an interest or a hobby or just something that I wanted to try, that's how I developed a passion for, you know, starting a show and interviewing others and writing, was really by just trying it. So I didn't know if it was going to be something that I loved or hated.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was my first company before I started the Rise to the Top was I got brought in on a company that was professional inline hockey. So hockey on wheels, of all random things in the history of the world.
Wow.
And I was brought into this company, and that was my first entrepreneurial experience. It was a new company. I ended up taking it over after a year. Lot of successes, a lot of failures in this company. But what was cool is I ended up having a radio show locally in St. Louis on a local station. No idea what I was doing. No idea. But it got me excited. It kind of turned me on, if you will. You know, I was like, this is going to be fun. And I got in there. I'm like, this is great. I love taking the phone calls. I love doing the show. Was I any good at it at the beginning? No, not at all. But I was excited about it, so I started improving. You know, week after week, it got better. It got better. It got better. I started liking it more and more. And at that point, I really started to develop sort of a love for passion. Anyone around me, a love for creating content. And anyone around me knew I liked to talk. So combining activities I already enjoyed. And I think that's one of the key things, is knowing yourself, the types of things that you enjoy, and basing your business and your daily activities around that. Like I call it, you know, kind of a 60% rule. If I'm spending 50 to 60% of my day doing an activity that I really love, then I will get all the crappy stuff done as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't like to do accounting, right? I don't like to do this. I don't like to do that. But you know what? I do it because I love the other stuff that I'm doing so much. And what with the rise to the top, I mean, it was the same thing. I took this passion for really since I was young. Youngish, like, you know, in college, I had this passion of being interested in people making money in creative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Not the typical way, like of just, you know, my grandpa was a very typical business person, big office, you know, cubicles, water coolers, stuff like that. He was like a traditional entrepreneur. To me, that was extremely boring, being on the creative side. And I've kind of made it a quest now, and that's what I do on the web show, is I interview the world's most passionate, interesting, unique entrepreneurs. And I bring them on, and they tell their stories, and I think it fuels and fires everyone up to kind of hopefully, you know, pursue something like that themselves, as opposed to, you know, a company that you're going to flip or a company that, you know, is something you just don't want to do, but you think it's a good idea. Those type of things are not necessarily who I'm approaching, and that's kind of what's fueled me over these last few years, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that people get really intimidated about the term passion, and it's like it doesn't have to be, you know, niche is another one where people get all kind of head up and stressed out about, oh, I haven't found my niche, I haven't found my passion. But it's like a passion can be just as simple as I like talking to people and I like creating content. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be this huge, mystical, you know, scary thing, and just, yeah, like you're saying, just what you're good at and what you like to do. It's like,
you know,
going back and thinking about it,
Exactly. And the example I'm thinking, and here's an example that is used so often, but not for this. it's one of those examples that is used for something else, and it's Zappos, right? Zappos is used usually as literally the most cliche example of all time when it comes to, like, social media and customer service.
Yeah.
You know, and for those that don't know Zappos, it's, you know, it's the online shoe retailer that's, you know, got, you know, $10 zillion in sales. And Tony Hsieh, the founder of Zappos, has been on my show before, and he actually read the book and gave a nice quote for the back, which was nice of him. But Tony is an interesting case of this because Tony is not passionate about women's shoes, right?
Yeah, I know. And actually, when you were saying that, when I was saying the question, I was actually thinking about Zappos. I thought, I wonder if that guy actually, I mean, does he care about women's shoes?
He's not parading around in a tutu with women's shoes on during the day, like, or like smelling the shoes and stuff. You know what? And if there's someone that does that, great, go for them. They should build a business around it. But the idea here is that Tony's passion is way beyond the product. Tony's passion, and I asked him this point blank, I said, Tony, I said, you're not walking around women's shoes all day. What are you passionate about, right? And his passion was he enjoys going to an exciting work environment every single day. So a culture that is, you know, fun and relaxed, and they play games and they do craziness and they like have this very quirky culture. And so he created a company around that culture that happens to sell shoes. And
like,
it's
they could have sold anything, really.
They could have sold coffee mugs. They could have sold, you know, whatever. The point wasn't the product. The point was he gets his interest from these people and kind of redefining an industry. And I think that's a great lesson. You know, a lot of people think I don't know what it is. Well, just think of natural stuff that you already enjoy doing and then take those activities. Like, I love playing hockey, so I got involved in a hockey league.
Mm-hmm.
I like creating content. So I decided to start my own show. The experience and the how-to was less important than saying why I wanted to do something like that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest takeaways from your book is a lot of the smarter, faster, cheaper options that you're talking about from marketing strategies are really online strategies, which online in general is cheaper than some old school marketing methods. So of the many online options that we're all bombarded with as far as marketing strategies, which ones do you think are the most effective? I mean, which ones do you really recommend?
Yeah, you know, and I'm an online person. Like, I love the online world, and, you know, I don't think anyone would argue with the trend that more and more people are getting online as opposed to more and more people getting offline, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, and online, you realize, of course, Sharon, it's not just our computers anymore. You know, online is phones. Online is televisions in many cases now with streaming television and things like that. Online is tablet computers. Online is inside cars in cases. So online is a big term, you know. And the way that I see it is, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all model. It's not like that these exact tools are going to be what builds, you know, things that are going to be the same for everyone that are going to work. But here's what I've noticed. Part of the smarter, faster, cheaper method that I've discovered from my own experience and then, of course, you know, 200-plus interviews with people that use it in some form or fashion is this. It starts with creating your own content online that you publish on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about it could be a blog. It might be a web show. It might be a video series, but some kind of educational, entertaining and inspiring content. There's a few ingredients in the secret sauce online, but number one is those that create content end up with the following. I've yet to find anyone that has a massive following online, like a big one, that doesn't create content in some form or fashion,
mm-hmm.
like whether it's a show, a blog, a funny art gallery online, cartoons, I don't know what it is, you know, writings. There's so many different formats of what you can create, but you have to create something. The second form of it is forming relationships. And I think that is often another buzzword that we hear a lot. But the way that I see it to get started is choosing two social sites that you feel comfortable with on your personality and also where the people that you want to attract hang out. And spending time on there, shifting out your own content, syndicating your own content, other people's content, but then the secret is getting in there and small talking and getting to know people. And I think that's what separates really the decent people from the really good ones. It's about that interaction. It's about humanizing one-on-one relationships and networking online. And that's what I've noticed. For me, Facebook and Twitter, those are my two favorite things. So I post my shows and my blog to my website, and then I go in to Facebook and Twitter. I put them out there, but I also am in there interacting, sharing other people's content, and spending time really building those relationships in there. And again, the strategy isn't a one-fits-all model, but the two things I want people to keep in mind here is having some kind of platform and having at least a couple outposts where they can send that platform and then also get in there and get to interact and meet people and you know, really start to build that following.
Yeah, and I think that's important, having your little own outpost or your own sort of home base that the outposts are drawing traffic to. Because, I mean, I think some people get so sort of distracted by social media that they sort of forget that this is about forging relationships and then getting their eyeballs to see. Because, you know, in 140 characters, they're not going to find out about you. But if there's a link in your Twitter profile to say, my website is the rise to the top, then they can go interact more. So having that home base for people to come learn more about you is still important. It's like people sometimes say, oh, blogs are dead. It's all about Twitter now. And it's like, well,
no way.
No way.
No, here's my thought on that. If someone says that, we don't own Twitter.
Exactly.
Right?
Good point.
We don't own, unless Mark Zuckerberg's on the line. If so, hi, Mark. We don't own Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is a critical thing. I mean, you cannot build on something that you don't own. It's like leased property that could disappear overnight. You know, if Facebook goes down, it goes down, and you're screwed if that's all you spent your time on. If Twitter goes down and is sold tomorrow and becomes Flitter,
yeah,
you know, you're done. And that's why you have to have that piece of real estate on the web that is yours,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that is so massively important, and that those other, you know, none of this is about the technology, you know? None of this is about the technology. It's about people and relationships. And if you're a publisher and involved in the publishing industry, you know that. That's how the publishing industry works.
Yeah.
And the ability to have your own platform that you can build up that people take part in is just a huge advantage. And using those other sites to really help build the relationships and also syndicate the content. That's how I see the strategy working way into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And I know that one situation, you know, some people are at varying, I guess you'd say, points on their online entrepreneurial journey. And for people who are just getting started, I mean, obviously, like you're saying, you need that home base. But for people who are getting started, one thing I read in the book that I thought was interesting, because, I mean, you actually started the Rise to the Top not really very long ago, and that you felt like you had actually spent a lot of money and had some regrets, and there were things you would have done differently if you were doing it now. Do you have any thoughts for those people who are sort of, you know, right now where you were 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I always try to look at, you know, mistakes or things that happen. And it was funny because I can list mistakes, but also if I went back, I don't know if much would change because, you know, the story has many chapters. And a lot of the chapters happen because something else happened. So, like, you know, a lot of things would randomly happen that would propel me forward or you know, in some weird sideways direction or somewhere. And it's hard to pinpoint it, but a couple things, you know, I'm very excited about people that create cool models online of, you know, publishing. And one mistake that I see that I made early on, so I started as a local TV show even before it became a web show.
Yeah.
And I was so bad on camera, okay? And what I mean by that was two things. One, I didn't have a lot of experience. And two, I was trying to act like someone should be on camera, quote unquote, as opposed to being myself. So
yeah.
I was like, I'm not kidding, I was like spray tanned and had like all this gel in my hair, and I was like stiff as a bull. I look at it, and that's still up, by the way. I leave it up for an example of what not to do. And my first show, I looked at it, and you know what? I was still excited. I was still excited that it was up. I was still excited that I enjoyed it, and I knew it could get better. And I think that one of the lessons that I learned early on, you know, that I think is kind of universal or a takeaway that other people can learn from is that as soon as I started becoming as authentic as possible, like flaws and all, you know, not trying to be perfect, not trying to act a certain way, but just be me, that is when things started to take off.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I did, as soon as I started being like, you know, I want this to be casual and fun and not a cutthroat thing, and you know what, I can get better on camera, I just need practice, and it's all true. And now, you know, I shoot my web show with my webcam and a microphone, and it gets 100,000 views a month. And it's scary that, you know, I was using all this expensive equipment, trying all these complicated things, and, you know, really the secret was just having something that was very real. I mean, I shoot it out of my kitchen now. Sometimes my fiance walks in, you know, during the middle of stuff and, like, wanders in. We've had guests where cats crawl across the screen. We've had guests where a baby appears and, like, peers into the camera. We've had guests where different things happen. But I think what ends up happening is that ends up being endearing, if you will.
Yeah.
It becomes being real. It feels like you're having a cup of coffee as opposed to the sort of polished media that we've always been used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so cool because it just makes it so much fun and easy. And you don't have to worry about that stuff. And I just think that, you know, I think that's just a testament of how this world is really just becoming more and more human. And technology allowing us to bring it together and make it that much more authentic. So that's kind of a longer story on one thing that was sort of a mistake.
I think that there's really a parallel too with writers and bloggers, where a lot of times those first few blog posts, you know, it takes you a week to write a blog post because you're worrying about it being completely and totally perfect, and you know, and in reality is that the first ones, you know, people are so worried about looking bad and things like that things never happen. It's like, this is why so many books are unfinished in my in my opinion, it's like, the, in theory, 80% of people want to write a book, but how many of them actually do? And I think a lot of it is this huge pressure that people put on themselves. Oh, my gosh, it's not going to be the... not going to be, you know, John Steinbeck the first time out. It's like, well, duh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think
everything takes practice.
Exactly. Practice, number one. And two is, like, the content police don't come and arrest you, you know?
Yeah, really.
Like, if you put out something bad, it's not like, you know, people are just like, oh, it's going to hurt my brand or what. You know what's going to hurt your brand is doing nothing.
Exactly.
You know? And the thing is, I've got all kinds of stuff up that it was, you know, there was problems or was flawed or whatever. And the thing is, yes, you keep getting better. It's not like you're going to turn on a camera or write your first, you know, post and it's going to be the most amazing thing in the history of the world. And I think you just have to accept that. And what's interesting about it that I've noticed is, you know, just approaching it as practice. I mean, trying different things, getting more comfortable with it, getting it up there, and just plodding forward, because the secret of success really with these platforms is the people that have been at it and consistently at it and always propelling forward are the ones that win. Those are the ones that have the following. They're the ones that weren't afraid to get it up there. And I think one accepting point that everyone needs to make is say, look, I'm not Shakespeare and I'm not Spielberg.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not. I'm going to let that go and I'm not going to worry about it, but I can be me. And let's just get it up there doing that. And I think that's a good way to kind of move it forward.
Another thing you talk about in the book a lot and you kind of mentioned is cultivating relationships online. And I know that in my case, I'm like a lot of writers. Many writers are really actually kind of hermits and introverts. And do you have suggestions for the shy retiring folks that aren't quite as, you know, big of an extrovert as you are for meeting these people online? Because it's sort of like, you know, I've seen Twitter compared to like a cocktail party, and you know, what if you hate cocktail parties and would rather die than?
Right. Here's the problem, and I hate to, you know, me and the title of the book too, fluff free, right? So I try to not BS with anything, give the answers that people want, and try to give them just the answer that I believe.
Yeah.
If you don't like people, you're not going to like these sites, and that's different than being an introvert. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying, you know,
the
bomber psychopath, but, you know, people who are kind of shy.
So here's the preface. Shyness isn't the problem. We'll get to how you can do that. But I just want to preface that if you're an introvert and you also don't like people, you're not going to do very well on the sites, right? But if you're an introvert, that's a whole different matter, and that's most of the people that are here. So let's talk about that for a second. Number one is that you can create in the medium that you're most comfortable with. Right? And in many cases, for the introvert, that is writing.
Yeah.
Usually. I could be wrong. There's some introverted that do other things. But, hey, writing or photos or, you know, mediums that aren't necessarily you with a camera on you, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I've noticed is that, yes, outgoing personalities might have a slight advantage, but just interacting with people, you know, it makes it easy behind a computer screen. It just is. I mean, it's literally typing and having conversations with people. You may not have the networking event example to use because maybe you don't like networking events because you're more introverted, but it doesn't mean that you can't network. I mean, there's a lot of people that I've seen that are very successful online that do not have outgoing personalities, and instead it sort of becomes an outlet for what they would like to say to the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, no one knows on social media sites, you know, if you're in there connecting with people, that you would feel uncomfortable coming up to someone in person. But I think that you have to be open to meeting new people. You have to be open to sticking yourself out there. You have to be open to being more transparent than you normally would and not have like a paralysis that, you know, I don't want to put my information online and I don't want to stick myself out there, because for this to really – for you to move your business forward or whatever your goals are forward, you really do have to become a part of it and show your personality, whether it's introverted or extroverted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's true, because actually, you know, you kind of see that a lot of times some of the introverts will end up congregating in, you know, a little corner of Facebook or a little corner of Twitter where the, you know, their brand of weird and introverted just kind of likes to go. their little corner of the internet. There's probably a corner of people who are a lot like you in one way or another, which is...
Yeah,
which
it's
is,
all over. I mean, all different personalities. Yeah. And, you know, and it's not like the internet was designed for outgoing people. It's not the case. I mean, it's designed for everyone. And I think that, you know, the tech community could especially attest to that, because the tech community is not necessarily known as the most extroverted community in the world. And that community has thrived online. I mean, there's something about it, you know, but what's interesting is that, you know, online used to be very anonymous, right? The internet used to be very anonymous. You would be Pretty Kitty 247 or something, right?
Yeah.
Now you're not. Now you're David Simon Garland. And I think that that can scare people, but it's the same idea. I mean, just be who you are. If you're a jerk offline, just be a jerk online. Just make it consistent.
Yeah, really?
You know?
Be yourself. If that's a jerk,
right,
then oh well. Then I'll be avoiding
you.
Okay.
Jerk, be the biggest jerk you possibly can. Be online and off, and just be yourself. If that's what you are, great. It's just that where the problem is if someone sees online one way and offline another way, sometimes it doesn't. There's a disconnect.
Yeah. Well, one thing that seems to be, I mean, and this is kind of particularly difficult in the publishing industry where, like, I think a million books were published last year or something, literally a million books. And so there's so much noise and there's so much competition and noise for people's attention. So one thing is, how can people rise above this sort of general noise level and actually get themselves noticed? Because that's a real challenge that I think a lot of people are struggling with. They're, you know, you've written a book, you've poured your heart and soul into it, and then you put it out there and nobody noticed that you did anything, even though you quote, did a whole bunch of things right as far as,
right,
you know, the way you're, quote, supposed to do it. And so how can people really get noticed?
You know, I think that, again, to get noticed, I've noticed a few different things. One, you know, is, like I said before, the consistent content is so important. Positioning yourself as a media source is important, and taking a very specific point of view with that. And I think that the world doesn't need less content online. It needs more passionate content, more
mm-hmm.
content that people actually care about. Because if you care about it, you want to get it out there, and you want to go have conversations about it. And if you don't care about it, you just want to do it, approach it as a job, and you'll get it out there. And what I've noticed is it's not about a trick to stick out. It's not about, you know, what gimmick can I do to stick out, right? Because everything in the book that I mentioned, it's more about a long-term relationship as opposed to a one-night stand.
Yeah.
Right? It's about how can I flip on a switch and have all these raving fans, but how can I build this up slowly over time? So a couple ways to think about that. Number one is, like I said, creating some kind of consistent publishing schedule. This seems like it wouldn't make you stick out. It actually shockingly does. Shockingly does. And what I mean by that is that you are going to post to your website a new article X times per week on a certain day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people start to expect when to show up. And that's a big part of it, because way too many content creators online do not have consistent schedules, right? And I'm not saying that it has to be 8 a.m. every day or whatever. What I'm saying is that for me right now, Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have a new episode that goes live. I create a lot of content. But Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have a new episode that goes live. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I have a blog post or another video. And people know that. People know to show up and see that stuff. And does it change sometimes? Absolutely. But you stick out by being consistent. And I know that sounds kind of like almost like an oxymoron,
mm-hmm.
but it's massively true, because not enough people do it. Every single person that I've talked to in the interviews in the book that get traction are consistent in one way or form.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes being inconsistent can be consistent, but we won't get into that. And so consistency is number one. Number two, and I think this one is interesting too, Susan, showing your personality and this is going to be scary for some people, but I'm telling you, it'll be worth it, okay? Your face. We want to see your face.
Uh-huh.
On your website, on social media sites. We don't want to see – this is the humanization of business that's right now. And people connect with people. And that's why my face is in the top left corner of my website, because I, you know, I'm sure it scares some people away. They're like, ah, who's that guy? Go away. You know? But the idea being that they know that there's a person behind this, you know? It's not a faceless brand. It's not like some random news site that you can't figure out who's behind it. You know, there's a rise of personal publishing now where people become fans of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do this by really showing who you are. And you can do that with a photo on your site. You can do that by adding some more personality in the copy that you do. That's the kind of stuff that allows you to stick out. And the bottom line with it, though, is to be creative in the ways that you're presenting stuff. Like, I decided to do a web show. You know, there's millions of blogs that are created every day, but what's your unique point of view? Like, there's a guy named Gary Arndt who does a blog called Everything Everywhere. It's everything-everywhere. And he travels the world with as few items as possible, and he blogs about it along the way. And it's one of the top 20 travel blogs, and it competes with, like, some of the biggest travel blogs in the world, right, for traffic and things like that. Why? Because he had a unique idea, and he went with it.
Yeah.
And I think if you do a plain idea that everyone else is doing, it's not going to work, you know?
Yeah.
It's just not. I mean, I can't tell someone this is the exact answer. You know, I just think that the idea is to look into your brain and say, hey, what is my unique idea? What's the thing that I'm excited about that's different? Because you have to have something that's unique. Otherwise, you're going to sifter in with the pack, and no one wants to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that, again, you sort of have to step back and really think about. You know, everybody, you know, there's the old saying about how everyone's got an opinion, but I think that a lot of times, and this sort of goes back to worrying about those first blog posts that are going to suck, and worrying about, you know, the content police and everything. But it's like a lot of times you see that people are just sort of afraid to have an opinion, and but it's like we all know you've got one out there. And
right.
Once you put those opinions out there, I mean, obviously somebody's going to hate them, but there's going to be people who are going to like them. And in some ways, it's like the more emphatic you are and the more passionate you are about your opinion, the more passionate your fans are going to be, it seems like.
Right. Exactly. You know, if you're not pissing off someone, you're doing something wrong. I know it, and that's one of the cool things, again, about online media is you get to kind of attract and bring in and interact with the people you want, and you don't have to with the people you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's one of the key things is saying things like, you know, okay, you know, sure, not everyone's going to agree. Sure, people are going to have differing opinions. But, you know, the key is having an opinion, exactly. I mean, having something that you're doing differently and having something that is strong, that's what you're going to do. It's just, you know, just offering information about something, no one's really going to care. That's why I think that, you know, having some strong angle is going to work well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Just like writing. I mean,
yeah.
Like writing anything.
Yeah, and the writing that, you know, if you think about the blogs that you want to read or the books you want to read, they're usually something that is making some kind of strong statement, and even if it is an educational thing, a lot of times it's at least authoritative, you know, it's like, we're saying this and here's why type thing. They're not just sort of, I don't know, I think I've read too many generic, like, crud articles on, like, e-zine articles and stuff that are just, like, rehashed crud, and it's like, the idea is just to rise above the rehashed crud and have something good and important and interesting to say, and then you'll get noticed.
Right, yeah, and I think that exactly that, and there's so many ways you can do it, you know, without having that drivel, and it's funny because for some reason, and I don't know what the psychology is behind this or whatever, but when you go online and you see a content creator, someone that you can see their face and you can see this, and they're creating, you know, I don't care what it is, text, video, audio. There is some kind of authority that comes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's something like you start to see people as a little bit of authority figures or someone that is at least a leader, right?
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing. And I'm not talking about being an expert jerk and talking down to people. That's the antithesis of this.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way that it used to be. It's like the experts, quote unquote, would have their website where they like shout at you about stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
And like you're an idiot and like they know everything and they're never flawed and they're always dressed perfectly, right? That's the way it was. And we don't want those people. We don't want to resonate. We don't resonate with those people. And instead, but we do, you know, latch on to leaders. I mean, we latch on to people and content creation, regardless of how many other blogs are out there or whatever else is going on. I mean, there's so many people out there online. Even if you have 20 diehard fans, to me that seems like it's worth it.
Yeah. On sort of another note, one way that you've managed to create a lot of content is by interviewing people. And I know you've done like 200 interviews or something. And
yeah, I think to date, including TV, web, some other underground shows, I think about 275, actually getting closer to 300 lately.
Ooh. So, I mean, getting all these people onto your show, obviously you know something about getting interview subjects. So what are some of the best ways you've found to approach people to be interviewed? I mean, you've interviewed people that don't give out really that many interviews either.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a combo. You know, the way first of all, again, it starts with small, and I started small. I didn't go after the top people right away. I started with people I knew early on. I started with, like, random entrepreneurs that I knew in my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, early on. That's how I got started, just by, hey, saying, hey, you want to come on? And what I noticed was that those people would then promote it to their communities one way or another,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, they would promote it to their Facebook and Twitter, if that was what they were on, or an email list, or, you know, call up a friend, whatever it is. And
yeah.
I started to notice, okay, well, this is interesting. And I slowly started to move up from there. I started, you know, one interview went to another. You know, you'd be surprised at what you can get if you ask.
Yeah.
And a couple tips on that. Number one, spotting people when they actually have something to market and promote. So an example, a new author, right?
Yeah.
A new author becomes, or a new book from an author, they suddenly become very accessible. Right? Because they know that interviews are it's valuable to them, it's valuable to you, it's valuable to your audience. So, you know, the most inaccessible people, look for a launch from them, you know,
mm-hmm.
of something.
Yeah.
It could be a product, a service, an announcement, something like that. Whatever that they're doing that's newsworthy, that's a good time to latch on for an interview. The other thing I would say, and this is especially true because we're so much more connected online now, and a lot of these high people, whoever you'd want to interview, are online somewhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for them to be accessible because they're online. Maybe they're on Twitter or whatever, or Facebook. That also means that a lot of people are bombarding them with things. And what I've noticed, a couple ways to stick out. Number one is most people on their website that are, especially when you're going after the higher-end people, will tell you exactly how to contact them. This is not an invitation to get creative.
Yeah.
Right? Like if someone says, I love email but hate and never respond to direct messages on Twitter, this doesn't mean to send them a direct message on Twitter.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised
how
many people offer that. You know, people will tell you, like Seth Godin responds to every email you send him. Every email. You're not going to get War and Peace back from him, but you'll get a response. Robert Scoble, one of the most influential busy tech bloggers in the world, he'll tell you he responds to his public things first, like a public thing on his Facebook or a public thing on Twitter. He'll respond to that first before email and private messages, right? Good information to know.
Yeah.
You know, knowing how someone likes to be contacted is a key thing. Also, getting to people face-to-face. If someone's speaking somewhere, they obviously are much more accessible than they are if they aren't. And, you know, it takes time, it takes effort, but you know what? That's how you can meet people.
Mm-hmm.
And another key way to realize this is not necessarily going right for the top of the mountain, but thinking of up-and-comers in your space. So think about people that are up-and-coming that you might want to interview. You know, Chris Brogan, I interviewed on my show when it was really up-and-coming, and it was kind of the reverse. Like, Chris saw my show as an up-and-coming show and wanted to be on it, and it was kind of funny how that worked out. And you know, those when people are starting their rise to the top, if you will, they're a lot more easy to find. They're a lot more eager to jump in, and they're also, honestly, much more likely to help promote it as well.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I've had that experience.
Right?
That's definitely true.
I mean, they just are. I mean, like, some of the highest-end people, like Tim Ferriss, who I had on, promoted the heck out of the interview that we did together. But you know what? I never asked him to do that. I never asked anyone to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I always have noticed that the up-and-comer, right, who's really hustling and really, really getting in there, and every interview matters and every media placement matters, regardless of size, they are going to do everything in their ability to get it out there.
Yeah.
And that's big for you. That's big for you.
Mm-hmm.
And them.
Yeah. Yeah, it helps everybody. And a lot of times some of the people who, you know, are some of the big names, then, you know, it's like they're not as motivated, whereas the guy who's still hustling to get those interviews is way more motivated to say, hey, look, I was interviewed on the Rise to the Top.
Right, exactly. And people, you know, again, resonate with that. And interviews kind of create that awesome triangle where you're creating great content, for people to watch or listen or read. And you also are, you know, getting to connect with someone big time, promote their stuff, which is a benefit to them, regardless of how many people you have listening or watching. Doesn't matter, because even one is good.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the other thing is, you now get a relationship with that person,
mm-hmm.
if you do it correctly, right? Like,
yeah.
Now you kind of have, like, I have sort of a little army of people that I've interviewed that I feel very comfortable with, just in general. Like, you know, if I need something or if they need something, we feel comfortable going back and forth. And that relationship came from an interview. And that has actually been the entire strategy, if you will, for my book getting out there, was people that I already knew and had a relationship with helping.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, people, I did the same thing with my books, is that, you know, once you've already got a relationship with them, it's much easier to say, hey, the galleys for my book are available. Would you like to take a look and let me know what you think?
Exactly. And it doesn't mean you come in like a Trojan horse and saying, you know, do this, because you owe me one or something. It's never that case. It's the case of exactly what you just said and did, is saying, hey, you know what? I've got it coming out. Would you mind taking a look? You know, whatever it may be. And I noticed that nobody turned me down. Nobody.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Well,
yeah.
And the other thing is that when you when they do something nice, like one thing that I did that always cracks people up is that people who spoke at our online conference afterwards, everyone gets a copy of the audio if you speak at it. We send it to you on CD, but we also send you homemade chocolate chip cookies. And I swear to God, there are now people who are like, I want to speak at the self-publishers online conference because I want the cookies.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I mean, you know, and the other thing is with the book, like when I sent people, I gave a handwritten note for every single person.
Yeah, and exactly. We did that too with the little thank you thing that I sent out. And people are just, I mean, it's like you say, it's like posting content regularly. When you do things like send a thank you note that's actually handwritten, I mean, people are just blown away because most people don't do that kind of thing.
Exactly. And it's, you know, and just because marketing has gotten faster and relationship building has gotten quote unquote faster, it doesn't mean that that's an invitation for laziness,
mm-hmm.
or to make it impersonal, you know?
So one thing I was curious about, you know, of the 275 people that you're, you know, you interviewed some amazingly successful people for the Rise show. Have you seen certain commonalities among them? You know, in what they've said and, you know, about telling their stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, you know, the most interesting people actually, you know, have a story to tell, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
They actually love telling stories, you know, and I think that's a huge thing. But what I've noticed from a business standpoint, and this was really a big premise of the book, like why this book even happened, was that I started to notice a pattern among some of my favorite interviews. You know, like we always have, you know, it's kind of like picking between children, but, you know, there's some interviews that definitely stick out.
Yeah.
Know, of ones that were just like, wow, you know, And I looked at those, and I said, why was that a wow? Like, why was I so excited about that? Why did I know everyone was going to be excited about that, you know?
Yeah.
And I went in there, and I started going around, and I started realizing that, you know, there were commonalities. Of course, the person was passionate. Of course, they had some kind of personality, right? Like, at least they showed it. It didn't have to necessarily be an extrovert, but they had a personality that they were willing to show.
Mm-hmm.
And three, you know, from a kind of marketing perspective or whatever, these people had that soft selling approach. They didn't feel like a blowhard. They didn't feel like that they were shoving a product down your throat. They didn't feel like they came on here just to be, you know, a sketchy product pusher. They came on to have a genuine conversation, show themselves, talk about the information, share a great story. And, you know, those are the people that are the most successful. It's the Tim Ferrisses. It's the Seth Godins. It's the Gary Vaynerchuks. It's the Chris Brogans. It's the people that, you know, are not coming on to manipulate anything or have some kind of, like, complete secondary gain overt. It's the people that come on just to share. And those are the people that gravitate. The more authentic and the more real they are, the more people gravitate towards them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. That makes a lot of sense. One thing I thought was interesting in the book, you describe, you know, how you came up with the rise to the top and that the revenue model is actually based on sponsorships because, you know, you're creating all this great content. How do you make any money? And I was curious how that kind of came about, because that's a little different than a lot of content producers have done, really. I mean, and like, for example, I've looked into getting sponsorships for my pet rescue association and didn't really know much about it. So I was actually really particularly curious about that kind of business model, because it sounded like from your description when you were talking about how you came up with the show, that you had thought of that pretty early on, I think.
Yeah, you know, that was the model I had come up with, and that was the model that I had learned, you know, through pro inline hockey. I went into pro inline hockey, no sponsorship experience. They said,
oh, yeah,
you have to figure out a way to make money. And so I decided to try sponsor. I had no idea what I was doing, right?
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to get sponsors. And, you know, it was a trial and error situation. But, you know, after 2 years with pro inline hockey, I had Anheuser-Busch, Pepsi, On the Run Mobile, UPS, BMW, a few other big ones. And, you know, I was like 21, and I still had no idea what I was doing. But the idea, sponsorships, like everything, are built on relationships, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it started with one. You know, it started with one sponsor and then getting a referral to another. And I wish there was some secret sauce for sponsorships or explaining, like, you know, what makes it work and what makes it does not work. But here's the thing, especially if you're dealing with larger corporations, you have to be tight in what you are offering. Like, it cannot be like wavering, like a lot of content creators do. Like, you know, oh, it might be this or this, and it might cost this much or this much.
Yeah.
And it might end here and it might not end there, right? There has to be a beginning, middle, and end to it. It has to cost a certain amount and offer a certain thing. I know that sounds so basic, but you'd be surprised. There has to be an offering on there. And for me, you know, now it's sort of flipped a little bit. It used to be I had to go out and really be aggressive with hunting down sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's starting to be a little bit more inbound as the show's grown. But
yeah.
You can't be afraid of going out there and asking for it, regardless of how big your audience was. I was able to, sell when my show started, I was able to raise and realize we had a lot more costs when it got started because of the TV, right?
Yeah.
But I was able to raise about $85,000 in sponsorships before we shot 1 second of the show.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that I wish I could tell you that there was some secret formula to it and there was some secret, you know, way that I did it and whatever, but it was really, I swear to God, just being excited about the project and asking anyone who would listen to me if they had an idea for a sponsor. not asking people to sponsor, asking people to introduce you to someone that might sponsor. The separation was unbelievable. I mean, you know, this guy was like, oh, well, my aunt's cousin's daughter's dog's friend knows this guy. and, you know, he knows the sponsor. And, you know, you got to get out there and get it done. And I just think that that was the way. I wish, you know, I get that question a lot, and I so wish I had a better answer. I wish I could be like step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, sponsor. But, you know, it really just takes, you know, getting out there and hustling for it and, you know, selling a bigger vision and something that people know that you're serious about. And, you know, it's a challenge. Next year will be a bigger challenge for us because we go to much more national sponsors next year. Mm-hmm. This year was more of a mix of local and national. Next year is going to be mostly national, and that's going to be a new challenge. And with that will come all kinds of challenges, but it's a constant game, and I think it's still a great model moving into the future because I also preach to companies that you need to pay attention to the little content creators. You know, the people that have an audience that is legitimately passionate about it. And what you have to sell to these people the opposite way that the big media companies sell to them, right, which is based on number of impressions and all these, like, other metrics of advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I try to use the small ball game. I say, look, forget all those big numbers. We've got a passionate community of people that want to be there, right? And I can offer you these three or four things that big companies can't do. You know, because I have a relationship with our audience, and most big companies don't. And this is what we can do. And that seemed to work well to kind of offer it as an alternative to those big budget things. And that's kind of one of the ways that it was built up. And that's probably the most concrete thing I can talk about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we're kind of out of time, and you're a great interviewer. So are there any questions that I haven't asked that I should have?
Oh, that's a good one. No, I this was extremely comprehensive. So I would have I think that, you know, as long as everyone found some value in it and got at least, you know, one good idea or thing that they can do, I think that we've done a pretty good job.
We've done a good job. Cool. Well, I know you have places to go and book launch activities to go off and do. So I'd like to thank you for taking the time to be here. And
oh, my absolute pleasure.
For those people listening later, I want to make sure that I give out the URLs. You can get more information about David's book, which, like I said, I did read, and it's an excellent read. You can read more about his book at www.smarterfastercheaper.com, and you can visit his show, The Rise to the Top, which is at therisetothetop.com. As well, and there's a lot of great audios, videos, content. I mean, it's quite a wealth of information.
Yeah, you'll spend a lot of time on there. It sometimes can be the succubus. You know, you just go from one art, a lot of stuff.
So anyway, I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and go off and create some content. So,
sounds good. Thanks, Susan.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks again for the book. I really appreciate
my pleasure.
It. And good luck with the rest of the launch.
All right. Well, thanks so much.